Welcome to CRE Radio with Howard Klein, radio for and about the commercial real estate professional. Our focus is exploring issues facing landlords and tenants, property and asset managers, investors, brokers, lenders, and everyone in the industry. Our style is conversation over coffee with highly experienced commercial real estate professionals. Over 35 years, Howard's legal and commercial real estate practice has centered on broker, leasing, and property management issues. CRE Radio is presented with the intent of engaging, educating, and entertaining our audience. Access our archive shows, upcoming schedule, and engaging articles at creradio.com or subscribe to the show on iTunes by searching for CRE Radio. And now, here's Howard Klein.
Welcome to CRE Radio and TV. Today, we're going to be talking about healthy buildings. Our special guests include Simon Turner of, what else, Healthy Buildings, and Carolyn Ricard-Bredeau. Carolyn is a partner and office president for Little, which is an expanded services and architectural firm, which you'll understand what we mean by expanded. Before we get into the show, let's give a little credit to our sponsors. The show is brought to you by The Broker List, the CRE community's first free online platform for finding brokers, deals, services, and vendors. And Leverage PR, the PR firm for your CRE firm. Publicity to grow your business.
Why don't we start out with what is a healthy building? And either one of you can start. Why don't I start out with Simon, since he was the first person that I had contacted with regard to the show. What is a healthy building?
Well, that's a short answer, a short question with a long answer, isn't it, Howard? To me, at least, and everyone's going to have a different opinion about what a healthy building is, but to me, at least, a healthy building is all about efficiency. A healthy building is an efficient building. And by that I mean that one way to think about these buildings that we work in, put aside residential buildings for the time being, let's just think about the buildings that we work in. It's a machine which helps work on behalf of us humans that run around inside these buildings. And so that machine has to operate as efficiently as possible. And so, yes, of course, by definition, that means energy and water use and resource use, essentially. But beyond that, and getting into what a truly healthy building is one where the people in that building, the little pink things that run around inside that machine, are operating at their most efficient. So they are productive and they're happy and they're doing whatever they do in that building as quickly and as efficiently as they possibly can. And that machine has to, and by machine I mean the building, has to contribute to that efficiency, essentially. So it's a very cold, analytical way of looking at a building, essentially. We like to think of buildings as our homes and as ways of protecting us and keeping us dry and warm and cool and all the rest of it. But at the end of the day, when we're talking about commercial buildings, those buildings are simply assets to the business that's being operated in that building. And it's the more efficient it can be, the better off the business that rents that building will be, essentially.
I would say from a design standpoint, as from an architect standpoint, a healthy building is something that really helps humans operate at their highest potential. So it really responds to human micro and neurobiology in ways that we're usually not even aware of, but in ways that we've evolved over millions of years.
What are the components, if that's the right description, of a healthy building? Carol, why don't you start?
Sure. The components of a healthy building, like humans, and if you think of our brains and how complex they are myriad and very complex. But they are things that help our bodies respond to our environments in ways that, again, are healthy for us. So there's a term called salutogenic design, which means designing for health or the origins of health. The opposite would be something where you'd be in a building and you've heard of sick building syndrome. It would make you sick as well. So the components include things like natural daylighting, include things like views to nature, include things like thermal comfort, include things like helping us get up and getting active in buildings. All those things, and there are many, many more than that, and that's just sort of the tip of the iceberg, are things that all have a beneficial impact on human health.
Yeah, I don't have a lot to add to that, Carol. I think it's a good description of what a healthy building should be. I think what we're going to see as a pattern during this conversation we're having is you're going to talk about buildings very much from this human perspective, and I'm going to talk more about the buildings as mechanical pieces of equipment, essentially. And that's a good mix for our audience, essentially, to think of it like that. For me, a healthy building is one that performs to its design. In other words, as long as we get the engineering and the architecture of the building right in the first place, the building's componentry needs to operate the way it was designed to deliver the results that you just talked about. So the mechanical system needs to provide the correct amount of outside air. The thermostats and the control systems have to deliver those thermal comfort levels and relative humidity levels that work for those human beings that you talked about. Of course, we all know that we have different expectations. Some people like it hotter, some people like it cooler, some people are less allergic to constituents in the air than others. So that's the other thing we've got. We need to deliver buildings to the occupants that keep a wide range of different sensibilities happy. And that can be tough sometimes.
I was first introduced to the concept of a healthy building actually through Green Build. And through Green Build, the concept that I was generally dealing with was sustainability. What's the relationship between sustainability and a healthy building?
Well, do you want me to have a shot at that one, Carol?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, to me, the indoor environmental issues that we're going to be talking about today are one component of sustainability, and that's what you see when you look at LEED. It's broken up into these little silos. You've got energy, you've got water, you've got sustainable sites, and of course you have IEQ as one of those different components. So, you know, healthy buildings, the health and wellness of the individuals in the building, if you want to call it that, is just one component of the overall sustainability picture. And we all know, without jumping too far ahead, that the focus on WELL buildings that Delos has brought up with their WELL building certification has got that more deliberate focus on the health and wellness of the building, and they let LEED do their thing with respect to sustainability. But this is really all about just this one component. One of the things that sometimes bugs me about LEED in general, and it's not their fault, but because they've got to get some organization into the picture, is it does tend to silo these individual components of sustainability. You think about energy, and then you think about water, and then you think about IAQ, as if those things all interact with each other independently. And we all know that they don't at all. I mean, IAQ and energy in particular, indoor air quality and energy, are closely integrated and interlocked. And sometimes they work at odds with each other. I mean, ventilation rates are a good example of that. The more fresh air you bring in, depending on the climate, the more expensive it is in terms of energy use. So as clearly as we try to silo it, they're really integrated.
What I would add on to Simon's explanation is, yeah, I agree. I think that LEED is really about resource use and about sustainability with regard to resources. WELL is really about human sustainability. So it's about operating, again, at highest levels of performance based on the way that our bodies are wired and our human neurobiology.
Let's talk a little bit about why anybody should really care. As I perceive it, there are a number of different players that deal with commercial real estate. There's the tenant, there's the landlord, and for the most part, and those representing each sides. And then there's the public and the government perhaps representing the public. Let's talk first about landlords. And we'll start with Simon on this one. Why do landlords care about healthy buildings, or why should they care about a healthy building?
Right. Okay, well, I'm going to break that question down. First of all, you asked me about landlords. You didn't ask me about building owners or corporate building owners. You talked specifically about landlords. And a landlord is running a business. That's really all he's doing. And the tool that he uses, the asset that he uses to make profits on is, again, this machine that he's leasing out to people to use so they can run their businesses. It's as simple as that, really. I remember John Cushman once talking to me about, or talking to me, talking to a group of people about real estate, commercial real estate management and ownership. And he said, it's really all about the numbers. And I've never forgotten the way he said that. If you have a good command of the numbers, and you understand how businesses operate, running a building is really not unlike any other business that you operate. So what you have to do when you run a business is listen to your customers and meet their needs. So again, Carol, this is a cold-hearted way of thinking about buildings, and I know this must be making you wince hearing me talking in such a
cold. No, not at all, because what it does is it drives competition.
Yeah.
So the owner wants to be able to lease their building or sell their building, depending on what kind of deal they're looking at, and they want the building to be more attractive. Now, if the owner can say, look, the building that I've got for you is going to be better than the one across the street because it's going to make your people smarter, more engaged, healthier, happier, potentially live longer lives, that's a benefit. You know, that's something that's a tangible benefit that I feel would make a building more attractive to a tenant.
And obviously that now you know, this really breaks down to the individual tenant customer type that you're talking about. So, you know, if you're talking about a Class B or C building where the small businesses that operate in those buildings, it's all about the cents per square foot rate, and they'll deal with all of that mumbo jumbo, quote unquote, on their own. That's one thing. But when you're talking about higher end buildings where there's a lot of money at stake and very highly compensated employees, this stuff begins to get more important, both for the tenant employer and for the owner. And then the brokers who are leasing that space to those tenants and interacting with the landlords need to be sophisticated enough to recognize that the benefit that they're bringing to their customers, which are the tenants as well, essentially. Tenants are a lot more sophisticated than they used to be on this, and they understand they've got more choices and options over this than they used to be. So this, I believe, is going to trickle down from, you know, the very higher end buildings until it becomes mainstream, and it'll take time. You could say the same about LEED. Many of the practices inside LEED have trickled down from very elite buildings until things like energy audits and commissioning are now going on in lower end buildings, essentially. And I think we'll see this same focus on tenant well-being and health and productivity trickle down from the very high end buildings on down as the practices become refined and market tested.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. The people that I'm seeing adopt or being interested in well right now are the most progressive companies. They're the ones that are very competitive markets. We see a lot of it in Silicon Valley, a lot of our clients out there. So it is, I think, the early adopters are the ones who are the most aggressive and the most progressive within the market.
And my guess is those are the ones that it costs the most to, and hopefully benefit the most initially.
Absolutely.
Because the other people aren't doing it.
Why don't we take a short break to hear from our sponsors? And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the type of certification that is available with regard to healthy buildings.
Are you a real estate broker? Do you have all the business that you want? If so, pay no attention to what I'm about to say. The Broker List. Yes, the Broker List can promote you so that you get more clients and listings. The Broker List can promote your property so that they sell or lease faster. And the Broker List can build trust so that potential clients know that you are the go-to broker for all things commercial real estate. Best of all, for you, it's free. Just go to thebrokerlist.com. That's thebrokerlist.com. And tell Linda that Uncle Howie sent you.
Welcome back to CRE Radio and TV. We are discussing healthy buildings with Simon Turner and Carol Ricard Bredeau.
When I first started investigating sustainability, I would see advertisements about green buildings. And I used to joke about it going, yeah, there's this apartment building. I think it was in Seattle that was advertising itself as a green building.
And what they claim made them a green building is they had bike racks in front of the building. This was 3 or 4 years ago, and it, just in the last 3 or 4 years, all of a sudden, you know, green is really more defined by a LEED certification, and it's better defined. What about the term healthy building? Can landlords just go out and say, this is a healthy building, and what does that mean?
Sure, anyone can say anything, but it doesn't mean it's true. What LEED brought to the sustainability equation is a set of criteria and measurements that were not subjective, they were objective. You had to perform to certain criteria. It's the same with WELL. Simon was talking about the Delos WELL Building Certification System, and I think that Delos is to WELL buildings as LEED is to the sustainability movement. So again, it's great to be able to point to healthy measures that are designed into buildings, and certainly there's nothing wrong with that. But if you're talking about how deep does the healthy go, I mean, you were talking a minute about greenwashing, which is really the term for just sort of putting a bike rack in front of a building. Health washing is the same thing. So you want to know, how deep does this really go? How much is it really going to impact the people that are in that building, and to what level?
Could you give a brief description, to the extent that you can make it brief, as to the Delos WELL Building Standard?
Sure. Delos is a company that was started by Paul Shalla, who used to be with Goldman Sachs, and he and his brother started this development company, and they decided that they wanted to focus on human wellness within buildings, the built environment. So they created Delos. And Delos then enlisted many experts around the world, actually, including people like the Cleveland Clinic and others that are sort of leaders in the world of health and wellness in the United States and elsewhere, to create this standard. And it is similar, if you're familiar with LEED, it is very similar to the LEED format. And since then, the International WELL Building Institute, the IWBI, is the body that's been created in order to govern and to administer the program itself. So there are 7 different criteria that the WELL Building Standard looks at, including things you might think of like air and water and light, but then there are 4 others that you might not have thought about, things like fitness and mind and comfort and nutrition. So it's a very holistic approach. It's something that looks at the whole individual rather than just picking and choosing, if you will.
It is still early days for the WELL. We're involved with the IWBI as well as consultants to help on the indoor air quality side and to work on their WELL AP exam. They're going to have an AP program just like we have a LEED AP. In fact, it's being overseen by GBCI. They're working with USGBC, or at least GBCI, to administer that through very much the same approach that we see with a LEED AP program. But they recognize, too, that it's early days for the process and that only elite buildings are going to even attempt to do WELL building certification for the time being. And their hope is that, again, it'll spread like a prairie fire and it'll start to trickle down to more mainstream buildings over time. It takes some adjustment to think of things like nourishment and the artwork that you have in the workspace as components of a healthy building. Certainly, you know, our focus is on the indoor air quality at our company, but to think about these other things, like where do you place and point to the stairwells to encourage people to run up the stairwells instead of just walk into an elevator, that takes a little lateral thinking, especially in an existing building where you can't exactly move the stairwell so that it's right next to the elevators necessarily. Although in often cases it is, it's just making a clearer, more pleasant pathway to those to that particular component of the building. So it'll be really interesting to see in the next few years how the WELL building program gets accepted by the market. And I don't just mean commercial real estate owners, I mean the tenants that are interested in occupying space in buildings.
You know, you raised an interesting point by saying that initially it's going to be primarily the Class A, the top-notch buildings, that are going to really start becoming healthy buildings. And the thought crossed my mind, and this might be particularly true in cities like San Francisco, where you have the millennials and the tech buildings, and they're taking warehouse because they can't get any other space. I think if there's a focus in taking a Class B or Class C building and making it healthy, you could convert it from Class B or Class C to a Class A building.
Well, you know, that's funny you should say that. Sorry, Carol, if I interrupted you there. Because if you think about it, a lot of the new techie space that we're seeing in places like San Francisco and elsewhere for those millennials is they're simplifying the design of the tenant space. They're gutting them. They're pulling out the ceiling tiles. They're putting in concrete floors and doing workbenches and simplifying them. You could do that in virtually any space. In fact, they'd rather have, in some cases, as you said, Howard, a brick facade on the interior face of the wall instead of drywall, and operable windows and smaller buildings, you know, with more direct connection to the outdoors, which is really hard to do in a high-rise building in downtown San Francisco. So then, you know, you may see a demand for those kinds of spaces in the future, which command the same cent per dollar per square foot rents than you would see in a central business district high-rise.
Yeah, I definitely would agree, because those buildings, as you say, Simon, it's much easier to get into the systems and pull them out. A lot of times what you have to address is the mechanical, electrical, and plumbing, all the infrastructure services. And in order to do that in a high-rise, especially in an urban situation with no lay-down space or area to administer to it, it's very challenging. But in a warehouse space or a distribution type space, it's much easier by virtue of the fact that you're not in a Class A building typically.
Carol, just stepping back for a second with the DALOS well, building certification and standards, it's my understanding that very few buildings have been well building certified.
That's correct. Currently, there's only one commercial space in the United States, and that's the CBRE office in LA. However, with that said, and that was certified last year. With that said, there are many buildings in process right now. We're doing a number of them ourselves, not only shell and core, but also the interiors. And they've got pilots and other building type formats, like educational buildings, residence halls, residences, period. So there are many different types of pilot programs that DALOS is running right now. And I would assume very quickly, in very short order, you're going to have a lot of buildings that are well certified across the United States.
And now, I'm assuming all three of us have been in the CBRE space, correct?
I have not. I've seen it.
Oh,
and
you
I've,
haven't?
I have not. But I've been on panels with the folks who did it, but that's as close as I've gotten.
Now, Simon, you're close by. You've been in the CBRE space?
I have seen more pictures of that space than you can shake a stick at. And I confess, too, that I've not physically been in the space. So you've caught us both out there, Howard. Good job.
Now, I'm so surprised. Now, I actually...
I have no excuse. I should have been in it.
I've actually been in the space, so I'll just, to the best that I can, give the description. And this all relates to healthy buildings. I was invited by David Pogue, who's the director of corporate responsibility. I believe that's his title with CBRE. He gave me a personal tour of it, and I've got to say that the second you walk through from the elevator into the space, and I'm sorry, it's really quite a walk up all those stairs to get there, so in that particular case, taking the elevator probably makes sense, but you feel different. So you can't really describe it well in pictures or video. It is... I think the epitome of healthy building, because it's how it makes you feel.
Yep, exactly. It's really affecting you on a molecular level, again, in ways that you don't know really why, but you know you feel better and you feel different.
Well, one of the reasons I think that that space works, and you know, according to the surveys they've done of the employees who work in that space, is that the employees have choice. They have control over where they work. They can sit at a workbench with colleagues. They can go tuck themselves in a corner somewhere. They can even use some private offices in those spaces if they want. So they have choice. And I've seen this throughout my whole career, that what people who work in buildings really want is control. They want control over their environment. And the way air-conditioned spaces with sealed windows generally work is there's no control. It's all centrally done. For energy efficiency reasons primarily, and that bucks the our natural urge to have control over our space a little bit. And so I think that's one of the reasons why that particular space works, is that people have choices.
I could agree with you more on that. There are other aspects to it. They deal a lot with the lighting, and the change in lighting was a very important element. And they had all kinds of issues with regard to the HVAC, and I don't recall how they solved those issues, because one of the things is they were trying to be platinum certified, LEED certified. So they had to do this balance between energy consumption and the healthy building thing. And I don't recall exactly what it is, and I probably should call up David or Lou Horn to explain this a little bit better. But they just, boy, I would give my right arm to be able to work there on a regular basis.
But this is the point, that if you can demonstrate productivity improvements, and that's the hard thing to do, but if you can actually show productivity improvements with healthy buildings, the cost of changing the HVAC, let alone operating it, are far eclipsed by productivity improvements, especially when you're dealing with high-end space with heavily compensated employees. And that is why tenants are willing to run the numbers on this stuff. What we need is really good evidence that a healthy building is one that does improve productivity and that can impact the bottom line of the businesses that operate there.
Why don't we take a short break to hear from the people who pay the bills around here? We'll be right back. Are you a real estate broker? Do you have all the business that you want? If so, pay no attention to what I'm about to say. The Broker List. Yes, the Broker List can promote you so that you get more clients and listings. The Broker List can promote your property so that they sell or lease faster. And the Broker List can build trust so that potential clients know that you are the go-to broker for all things commercial real estate. Best of all, for you, it's free. Just go to thebrokerlist.com. That's thebrokerlist.com. And tell Linda that Uncle Howie sent you. Welcome back to CRE Radio and TV and our discussion about healthy buildings. Carol, is there anybody who's doing any metrics or measuring how healthy a building can be?
Companies that are going out to measure what's the return on investment, what's the ROI. And what we're finding is the companies that are actually doing the measurements are now developing metrics, and those metrics are proving out. So for every dollar they're spending on a health program, they're getting a $3 to $5 return in lower absentee rates, in the metrics that they're taking for body mass index, for cholesterol reading, for blood pressure, etc. It can be as simple as that. But what we're finding are the ones that measure are the ones that can quantify.
From what I understand, the actual cost of the real estate is a minor cost to a company, the operating cost of a company, compared to human resources.
Absolutely. If you think about it, anyone who's looked at a balance sheet or a P&L, anyone who's got profit and loss responsibility in a business, sees a P&L, and they look along at the GL codes, and it's all there, it's all there in the direct and overhead salaries. That's where all the big numbers are. And then everything else is peanuts compared, including rent. I mean, rent is one of the larger other components, granted. But by far the most expensive components of any P&L are the salaries and the benefits that go with it. So anything you can do to make those salaries go a little further or save waste on those salaries is going to far eclipse any other operating costs that you have in the company.
Yeah, it's really about protecting the investment, because not only are you hiring these people, you're training them, you're investing resources in them. So really, well design is the ultimate investment in people in an architectural sense.
Yeah, we're now starting to talk about, why tenants care. And actually, landlords care, because the more tenants start caring about protecting their investment in the people that work there, the more the landlords are going to start caring, because then all of a sudden people are going to start choosing the healthier building than otherwise. There must be some studies indicating the value to the employer, and metrics, indicating the value to the employer over X number of employees and certain, I guess it varies between region to region, but I don't think there are any hard numbers, are there?
Well, there's a good page actually on USGBC's website called The Business Case for Green Buildings that summarizes, quite good actually, Carol, if you've seen it recently. They put together a summary of many of the different studies that are out there that look both at energy, costs and rental rates and productivity benefits and all of those different economic parameters against the value of investing in green buildings in general. So that page that they put together, USGBC, is a good read, actually. It's a good summary of the available data. I mean, I'm sure it's not fully comprehensive, but it's not bad. And obviously, they had every incentive to put that page together. And if your listeners and viewers, Howard, want to review that, that's a good page to go to.
Yeah, and I would say that just as people who are measuring their health programs and benefits, the return on investment there, we're starting to amass data that is allowing us to create metrics for those things as well. Part of our process, actually, when we do a project, we do measurements before and we do post-occupancy evaluations as well. So we're, again, amassing data that now we're being able to look at, as metadata, really, and looking at trends, things that are happening within different types of industries, different types of buildings.
It's been a holy grail for a while, Howard, being able to measure productivity against different factors inside buildings, be it ventilation rates, be it lighting, be it a well-building program, and then being able to compare with scientifically valid controls whether or not the people in that building are more productive or not. I mean, you can reduce the argument down to it's absurd and say, well, all right, we'll stick someone in a dark, dank, musty, unventilated basement and see if you get the same productivity out of that individual, than you would in a light, airy, comfortable working environment that's designed to help the individual focus. And, and then reduce it down from there.
Well, and if you think about it, Simon, I love your example of the dark, dank basement, treating someone like a mushroom, essentially. Think about what your body is. Your body is wired to survive. So anything that causes stress distracts you from what you're supposed to be doing. If you're in a building or in a space like Howard was describing for the CBRE offices, where you walk in and you feel great, you're going to do better work. You're going to there are metrics that show that exposure to natural daylight increases accuracy in work, increases productivity in work. So yeah, there are a lot of things that sort of bear out the fact if you feel better in a space, you're going to do better in a space.
Yeah, I don't think that it's a question of whether or not a healthier space will overall increase employee morale and productivity. I'd be surprised if anybody really questioned that. I think where the metrics and the data come into play is the question of how much. How much are you going to spend in order to increase that productivity? I mean, there is a base number where you would go, look, I care about my employees, therefore I don't want to put them in the position of being unhealthy. All right? But then the next question is, how much money am I going to spend? Am I going to put in that lighting that changes during the day? Am I going to put in those special filters in the air conditioner or set up the HVAC system so that it optimizes how they work and then get complaints about it being too cold, which wouldn't be a problem for me. So I think that's what it's going to come down to. And what I've seen over the last few years is the states and municipalities are more and more requiring landlords and tenants to maintain or develop data and produce that data to the governmental agencies or whatever agencies are requiring it. And as that increases, more and more data will be available, and then there'll be metrics that can tell us and give better guidance on how much money you might want to spend or not spend.
So yeah. Really, I'm sorry, Carol, go ahead.
Well,
I was brought up properly too, you know, by my mother.
I see that you were. That in that case, I will interject.
Told me ladies first, so there you go.
So, well, Delos would tell you that the added cost, construction cost to implement these measures would be anywhere from 0.5% to 1.5% of construction cost. Obviously, what you described, you pick and choose. I mean, I've got a project where we're using an existing building, and the existing building has got some issues. So, yeah, certainly the tenant, the ultimate user, has to decide what's going to be the biggest benefit to them. And like LEED has different graduations of certification, it's the same with Delos. The Well Building Standard also has, you enter at silver, and then you go up from there to gold, platinum. So there are different degrees of conformity and different degrees that you get rewarded back in your certification.
Well, what I was going to say is that a large element in creating a healthy building is about being sure that people who make the choices are the education, so they understand what they're doing. And it comes down to choices, not necessarily money. Can be money, but if it's about selecting the right space, selecting the right lighting, ensuring that the building is not neglected. Again, a lot of our focus here at Healthy Buildings is about mechanical equipment. Is it being neglected? Has it been neglected? Carol, it sounds like a building you're looking at may have had that. I don't know. But
most of the time the answer is yes, it has been neglected.
Right, and exactly. So a building that's been looked after and been maintained properly, you have no idea how much of the IAQ issues we run into when we inspect buildings is just down to poor maintenance. Mm-hmm. That if it's a building that just hasn't had the TLC that it needs in terms of ensuring the ductwork is kept clean and the air handlers are not moldy and the filters haven't fallen out of place and the outside air dampers are open and the pooled water sitting on the rooftop, you know, has been dealt with, or somebody put a generator right next to the outside air intake some point in the building's life, or something like that, or just all kinds of little issues like that can make all the difference between a building that's pleasant to work in and one that's got little things that niggle people. So in many cases, it's really about money, it's about choices. And the other thing I want to say is that when you look at this modern warehouse space, as you called it, Howard, spaces that are collaborative in nature, and you know, look at some of the very best of them that I have toured, that are relatively simple. Landlords love these spaces because they're open and require the bare minimum of TI. If anything, they need to take stuff out. And then they've got this, when the tenant is finished with his lease, they've got this open space that doesn't need a lot of demo for the next tenant if they want changes to it. So it could actually save money, depending if the right decisions are made.
Carol, you made a point earlier, and a point to me in our earlier conversations, that this is not, in order to have a healthy building, or what you deal with and you've been studying, is it's not all about the construction and the physical premises or the components of the physical building. It's much, much more than that, and sometimes it's not even that expensive to make the environment more healthy for the employees. Why don't we talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, Simon was talking before about variety, and variety is very important, and control. Variety and control are both very important to humans. We have in our brains a neuron that is a novelty neuron, and its job is just to find out what's different in the environment. And that used to have an evolutionary requirement, because if there was a saber-toothed tiger hiding behind a bush, you know, you needed to be able to pick that out. We don't have that need anymore. So now we have these sort of vestiges of our evolutionary response, but they're trained on different things in our environment. So there's a lot of conversation about, is it open environment now? Is it all closed environment? It's the wrong conversation. It's both. There's got to be a number of varieties of different types of spaces. We recognize now that people learn. Think about the way children learn in schools or in colleges and universities. We understand that there are some people that are auditory learners, some people are visual learners, some are kinetic learners. It's the same thing. When you graduate from school and you move into a work environment, you're going to look for different types of environments that fill the need of what you're actually doing, not really respond to hierarchy, but design really is about what are the processes that are taking place in the space now. So yes, it's beyond just the hard wall construction. It's about lots of many, many different things.
We're going to take a short break and hear about the broker list and one of the best people in commercial real estate, Linda Day Harrison, the CEO of the broker list. Are you a real estate broker? Do you have all the business that you want? If so, pay no attention to what I'm about to say. The broker list. Yes, the broker list can promote you so that you get more clients and listings. The broker list can promote your property so that they sell or lease faster. And the broker list can build trust so that potential clients know that you are the go-to broker for all things commercial real estate. Best of all, for you, it's free. Just go to thebrokerlist.com. That's thebrokerlist.com. And tell Linda that Uncle Howie sent you.
Can we talk a little bit about the concepts of, I think you gave to me four concepts, active design, biophilia hypothesis, circadian lighting, and enriched environment. This was my opportunity to use some big words.
Well, enriched environments are really what I was just talking about. An enriched environment is something that gives the locus of control to the user so that there's flexibility. Simon is talking about a landlord loving a big, essentially a, like a black box theater almost, that the building becomes just a an envelope for what happens inside. So that enriched environment is something that's flexible, it's adaptable, it's scalable, it's movable, it's got all the pieces in it that needs to last, to let it last for a long time. Biophilia is really about a connection to nature. Again, because humans evolved as hunter-gatherers and we're out in the environment, we still have a, an evolutionary response to natural elements. So, you know, the phrase, get back to nature, there's a reason why there's that phrase. Nature's been found to calm people down, it reduces stress hormones, it reduces blood pressure. It helps you reset once you've hit a stress level. If you go outside and you take a nature break, it actually works. It's a real thing. It's a tangible thing. So biophilia is very important because of that natural response that we have to nature. Active design is really similar to what you talked about before in terms of putting an elevator in a place where it's not as easy to access. It's much more desirable to use the stairs or to use furniture to address that, whether it's a sit-stand workstation or a balance ball to sit on instead of just sitting behind a desk. There's something that people call sitting disease now, and it's really about how much time we spend sitting with our behind in a seat rather than getting up and moving around. And now I think scientists are really starting to understand how bad that is for chronic health diseases. So when you sit in a seat after 30 minutes, your metabolism drops 90%, good cholesterol drops 20%, the muscles in the lower half of your body turn off, which interferes with the way that we take in insulin. So our pancreases are working harder. There's a higher incidence of type 2 diabetes. Yeah, I know. It goes on and on.
I'm sitting here listening to you, and I'm going, could I do more things wrong?
Hey, Howard, am I allowed to ask a question, or are you the only one that can ask questions?
No, you can ask a question.
I have a question for Carol that you raised with me. You talk about how we need to make buildings adapt to our hard wiring so that we can exploit you know, our hard wiring a little better. There's a clear difference between the way men and women are hardwired. Don't we all know that? So my question is, how has there been any research, or how can we adapt buildings to adapt to gender preferences inside a work environment? Have you found that men prefer different environments than women?
Yeah, there was a study that was released actually, and it's just gotten a lot of play within the last two or three weeks, about temperature in offices and the fact that men tend to like temperatures that are colder and women tend to like temperatures that are
warmer. We've known that for years.
How much money did they pay for that study? Yeah. Because you just had to ask me that question.
But now they know why.
We'd known that men like it cooler than women for years. And it's there's a couple of social reasons for that as well that we've known for years. One is that men tend to move around more than women in offices, and also that women dress differently than men, and they tend to dress. Men tend to dress with a higher level of clothing.
If men wear a tie, specifically, yeah. That's one thing. That's one of the measures. Men also have more body hair, and body hair traps heat between your skin and your clothing. So men are a little bit more.
There's also some really interesting social studies that they may be getting outdated now. In that, in the old days, when you had old-fashioned layouts with corner offices and window offices, all the men who had all of the powerful jobs used to be ensconced in these perimeter offices in the corners, and the women used to be the secretaries and the admin staff that were stuck in the center, in the core of the building, in more dense space. And because you had sunlight and radiant heat on the perimeter of the building, you get more fresh air delivered through the VAV system into the perimeter spaces, so the men were simply getting more fresh air than the women that were in less ventilated spaces per square foot. So that was going on as a result of the way the social environments we had in modern businesses. Although, of course, that's changing, or has changed.
I'm curious now, what are the other differences other than the obvious men, are always warmer than women? And I didn't know about the hair thing. Unfortunately, I also have the body mass that I know has something to do with it.
Well, yeah, and actually that's the outcome that happens to women, is that when women are colder, when they're in colder spaces, when they feel colder, they are also prone to that diabetic reaction that I was talking about as well. So there are serious chronic health conditions that can arise from it. There are a lot of things people have talked about, embracing casual Friday on an everyday basis so that men aren't wearing ties in the work environment, so that you're not reinforcing, this thermal difference between the two genders.
That's interesting stuff. We've been talking about healthy buildings from the perspective of an office environment. How do these concepts apply to other types of commercial space, such as R&D, industrial, warehouse, retail, or even multifamily?
All right, I was going to say that, to me, that they are different machines. Different mechanisms go on inside those spaces and go on in an office building. A typical office space, the computer and the workstation is the tool that the individuals use to generate work. And if you're dealing with a factory or a warehouse or one of those other environments where productivity is measured in a different way, whether it's the movement of materials through a building, whether it's the production of something, you have different mechanisms at play that impact the productivity of that building. So it's very difficult to, at least from our perspective, to translate some of what we've been talking about into buildings where those different mechanisms are operating.
Yeah, I think where we see it, where we look at different types of buildings, is any space that's occupied by humans. So that could mean schools. When you're talking about elementary schools, secondary schools, etc., that talks about healthcare spaces. It does talk a little bit about retail, because you've got people that are working in those spaces. So you're trying to create environments that are healthy for people that are spending a long period of time in any particular environment. So we know that exposure to natural daylighting results in 16% higher test scores for children in K-12 schools. We know that in manufacturing facilities, as soon as you punch skylights in the ceiling in a large distribution or R&D type facility, you get, again, higher accuracy, higher productivity, because natural daylight is the number one factor in increased productivity.
One of the things that happens in, take a school environment, is that you get these rapidly changing heat loads where you have an empty room, and then suddenly 30 kids rush in, and they sit there for an hour or so during a class. And now the heat load has changed completely, and you've got this relatively inexpensive low-bid air handling unit on the roof or a wall-mounted unit that's supposed to adjust to these rapidly changing heat loads. And there isn't the sophistication and the control system in most schools to cope with that kind of change in heat load. As a result, you can get mold and condensation and all those other issues, let alone adequate ventilation into those spaces. So you have a totally different mechanical design challenge there than you do in a commercial building where the system kicks on at 6 a.m. or 5 a.m., and you have exactly the same heat load all day except at lunchtime when it dips slightly.
The lighting is an interesting issue, and we were talking about circadian rhythms. In my office, I probably have in my studio right now the worst environment possible. I guess I should just be grateful that I have oxygen in here, which sometimes it doesn't feel like I do. But because I film in here, I prefer daylight. So the LED lights that I use really are not that hot. That's number one. And two, I think they're like at 5,500 Kelvin, which is daylight white. And I had mentioned this going, well, gosh, maybe that's something really good. But, Carol, you had indicated to me, well, it probably doesn't make any difference.
I do know that there's language in the WELL standard about circadian rhythms and lighting in general. It is an important part of it. I'll throw out an anecdote for what it's worth, and that is next time you fly overseas on a big double-decker A380, it's really cool watching the way the lights come on slowly to local daylight time to your destination, and they dim so that you have dawn and you have dusk. They don't just snap the lights on with a switch. They come on slowly because they found that passengers adjust more easily and find it more comfortable when it's like the sun rising.
Yeah, because the nature of daylighting is different, and that's one of those things where we may not be aware of it, but in the morning light is blue in color and tells our bodies to wake up. We get a shot of cortisol and we go on our way, and evening light is yellow in color. It tells our bodies to release melatonin. We prepare for sleep. It helps repair DNA while we're sleeping, etc. So yeah, a lot of the Virgin flights, Virgin America and Virgin International, have that different color scheme when you get in to actually help you reduce your jet lag as you travel transcontinentally.
British Airways too, I'll have you know, Carol.
Excellent. I would expect nothing less.
How could we have not mentioned British Airways? So let's talk a little bit about where we are now and where you expect us to be in terms of healthy buildings 10 years from now.
I would say that one of our challenges is that buildings, by definition, change slowly. I mean, a building has a 50-year lifespan, say, and there are some elements of that building that you can't switch around fundamentally. They're set in stone, like the placement of where the air handlers are and some of the core MEP design aspects of the building, very difficult to change as quickly as the generations change. So in the space of 50 years, how many generations are going to be working in that building? And the expectations of those generations change so much compared with your generation, Howard, because you're so old, versus my generation because I'm so young. You're going to see that those expectations change much quicker than a building itself can change. And that's one of the challenges that we have, frankly. Then over time, enlightened architects such as Carol can make changes to the kind of equipment that's installed in the building from the get-go. And that's really, the best we can do. And in the meantime, all we can do is change out interiors. And get people more comfortable with them and build better buildings from scratch as we can.
Simon, what are the key takeaways from everything that we've discussed today?
Well, in my view, it's all about paying attention to the fundamentals. I love what Carol was saying about start with the end in mind, which is think about the way we vulnerable, weak humans are hardwired. Start with those human beings that work in the building as we're there to serve them. Everything we do, the way we lease spaces, the way we design buildings, everything in our entire industry is about serving those people who work in those buildings. When you start there with those fundamentals, you can start to get things right. Make sure they have enough fresh air. Make sure that air is clean and that it is delivered through systems that don't infect them or infest them, essentially. Look at and even the water, the way the water is delivered. I mean, in this day and age, we're giving people who work in buildings Legionnaires' disease. I mean, we got to start with the fundamentals and make sure that we're keeping people at least not getting sick working in buildings, let alone being as productive as they possibly can be.
Carol, what's your big take?
So the takeaway is, I would say, tagging on to what Simon said, as long as we put humans at the center of everything that we're doing when we're designing, then that's a good start. Because we're not creating buildings just to house bodies. The buildings that we're creating are to support the functions that are happening within them, whether that's an office building, whether that's a school building, or a healthcare building, or an R&D facility or distribution. So as long as we begin with those ideas and keep those things in mind, we at least have a good start. I think secondarily, it's also important to realize that healthy buildings, designing healthy buildings, makes sense for a landlord, for an owner, for the tenant. Initial cost or first cost might be significant, but the payback usually is pretty quick. So when you're using less energy for lighting because you're relying on a lot of natural daylight, or you've designed a building in such a way that you can take advantage of natural daylight, you know, there are benefits there that aren't necessarily obvious from the get-go, but when you stop and think about it, it's just smarter design. It's better for the folks who own the buildings as well as the people that are occupying the building.
Well, my takeaway is that we're in the process of selling our house. I have a home office that when we move into a new house, I'm going to make sure that my office has exterior lighting. I'm going to have one of those desks where I can stand. I'm probably going to have one of those balance balls that I can sit on, and then I'm probably going to hate working where I'm working, but it won't be any worse than where I am now. But no, I'm looking for just being in a healthier environment, and it's becoming just more and more significant to me. And I'm going to put one of those lifelike images. You called it the
Savannah image.
Yes, I'm going to do one of that, because then maybe I won't have to take blood pressure medication. If I move around more, I'll lose weight, and I won't have type 2 diabetes.
All good things.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to thank both of you, Simon. Thank you very much. You both were great. This was really a good show. And Carol, you also, thank you very much. And we'll be in touch.
Thank you.
Good to meet you.
Thank you.
Please listen again next time to CRE Radio with Howard Klein. Every live and recorded broadcast is accessible on your desktop, tablet, or smartphone at creradio.com, or in iTunes, just search for CRE Radio. Here's how to reach us with your questions, feedback, and show topics you'd like to hear about. On our website, click the comment button on any show page at creradio.com. On Twitter, send a reply to @CRE Radio. Via email to questions@CREradio.com, or call in during the live show at 619 area 393-6492 and press 1 to be placed in queue. CRE Radio broadcasts are presented on an informational basis only, with the intent of engaging, educating, and entertaining our listeners. Howard and his guests' conversations specifically do not offer legal advice. If you need legal advice, please consult your own attorney. Portions of the show may have been pre-recorded. Unauthorized editing or copying of the show without the express written consent of CRE Radio is strictly prohibited. All rights reserved.
That's a wrap.